Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In series two, we worked our way through an assortment of added Beatles goodies, such as Live at the BBC, the anthology series and the movies. And now, for series three, we are looking at all the post-Beatles singles released in the decade following their breakup. As with series one, we take five songs in random order each week and score them for music, production and lyrics to find the best post-Beatles Beatles hits. Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the Beatles. In the 70s, mostly. Welcome to series three, episode 10, and welcome to Paul Pumder Abbott.
Oh, right, you've gone off the thing and just started using my initials to make a strange sound.
Pumder. Sound like yes. Half a Thundercat.
I have two middle names. It baffles many, many systems that refuse to acknowledge it. Arcade machines, mainly, in the 80s. You couldn't put your high score in because you could only give you three spaces.
Yeah, three initials. Which one did you favour, the or the duh?
I used to just write PAL, I think.
PAL?
Yeah, like Paul without the U.
Oh, I see, yeah. Oh, that's
not that we went on the arcades very often, even though we did grow up in Scarborough.
And not that you got high scores as often.
No, not at all.
No, I remember putting Gna in quite a lot.
No, you're all right, you single initial middle name. Yeah.
But not in arcades, in our Commodore Plus 4. But that would be a whole of the podcast.
Yes, this is nothing at all to do.
This one's about the Beatles. So don't forget, you can keep in touch with us at @big_sort on Twitter and Instagram, or by email to bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And please drop us a review on whatever platform you're listening on if you can, and like and share our posts, especially so close to Christmas.
I mean, it's the greatest gift of all.
Greatest gift you can give a podcaster, except for maybe, I don't know, £100,000. Or something in that region, but that would be
the ambition.
Yeah, just no. Well, I'm just
theoretically thinking of what could I have? What, £100,000?
I'm thinking, you know, I don't want to put people off with too big a bid. Anyway, please check the episode description for links to our various other projects and music and whatnot. Paul, how are you?
I'm all right. I might actually have a new thing to promote when this comes out.
Oh yeah.
My band Good Grief have. Or should have, by the time this has come out, released some new songs. Ooh. I say new songs from the album sessions that we did a little while ago, but haven't been released elsewhere, on the exciting format of cassette tape.
Ooh, cassettes.
Because that's a thing now, yes. Again. Although you can get it digitally as well. So if you go look up Good Grief Liverpool on Bandcamp, you'll be able to see that we are releasing a tape, which, as of this moment, is called simply Tape.
Right.
And will probably stay called Tape, but contains four as yet unreleased Good Grief songs. New material. Buy it for Christmas. Send it to your friends, enemies, lovers, and people you hate as well.
Right. But of all of them, make sure they do or don't have a tape cassette player to play it on, depending on if you like them or not.
You can get it digitally, though, like I say. Yeah, get it digitally. Yeah. Be all right. Just put it on a shelf, let it get dusty.
The digital shelf.
Don't let the digital version get dusty.
No, yes, you don't want it dust in your digital. Well, that's exciting.
It is. It's a thing.
Very much vouch for your last album was brilliant, so I'm interested to hear these.
Ta.
Looking forward to that, for sure. Well then, let's have a Beatles Day, Paul.
Shall we?
Which is the 5th of December. We are in the month of December as of the date this goes out. So what have we got?
Well, we're going back to 1967, and I'm pretty sure I haven't talked about this specific day, although we definitely mentioned the Apple Boutique before.
Yeah.
At different points. But the 5th of December was the launch party for the Apple Boutique.
Yeah.
In 1967. I think it opened 2 days later to the public. And just to keep this in context, just so most people listening to this will know this, the Apple Boutique opens in December 1967, it's closed by the 31st of July 1968.
Yes, it's don't do very well, does it?
No. Yeah. Well, basically, I think the point is it sort of symbolised everything that sort of happened with Apple in those early days as much as anything, and very much was an example of the Beatles doing a thing and then going, right, done that, I'm bored, I'll stop paying attention to it and do something else.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was the launch party on the 5th of December 1967, which, if you want I like the Beatles because they both represent tons of stuff about the 60s, and you can sort of map out the 60s by the images that the Beatles present.
Yeah.
But they're also quite atypical. They're not quite the weird, you know, stereotypical 60s thing. It's a very odd thing. They're totally representative of the 60s, well, but also somehow...
They're a corner of the tapestry of the 60s that... They're not following the 60s. They are constructing it, aren't they? Their image and their iconography and them are their own little bit of it rather than derivative of other things, aren't they?
Very much so. Although what I'm saying here is, if you look at the footage of the cover, like the coverage of the opening of the Apple boutique, it is the most 60s thing that you can get. You know, it is flower power because... you know, there's the Fool, the sort of art and music collective designed a lot of the clothes and the big painting on the side of the building in Baker Street and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's all bells and whistles and, you know, as groovy as can be type stuff.
Yeah.
You know, all the hip people are there. So I tried to write a list. I'm sure someone's got a much more thorough list of this, of people who attended the opening. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that the list would start John, Paul, George and Ringo, but it doesn't. It starts John and George because Paul was on holiday and Ringo was filming. So it's not like they were even all there.
Yeah.
So John goes there with Cynthia and George's there with Patty. Then you have people like Terry O'Neill, who's a photographer. You have Jenny Boyd, who's Patty's sister. Mm-hmm. Cilla Black, Twiggy. You have all of the lot from The Fool. You've got Clapton and Bruce from Cream. Mm. Neil Aspinall's there, obviously. You have the theatre critic Kenneth Tynan. Richard Lester turns up. Victor Spinetti's there. You've got DJ Alan Freeman. You've got some clown giving out apples, like a
like clown.
Creepy clown.
Yeah.
Tom Mashler, the writer. John Kasman, the art gallery man I've written down here. Olin Aldridge, who's a designer, and all sorts of people there, you know, lots more. But it's all very, look at the foot. The great thing is the footage is all in black and white.
Right.
But of course, it's like very, very colourful a place.
Yeah.
No alcohol license, so they're having to drink apple juice. The announcements for the thing sort of come at 7:46, fashion show at 8:16. It's like, that's zany times you've chosen there. Yeah, it's so very, very 60s. You like, there's footage of George sitting down on like one of those inflatable armchairs.
Yeah.
Like a see-through inflatable armchair, like Terror of the Autons from Doctor Who.
Mm.
It's going to fold in and eat him or something like that. It's worth looking up the footage if you've never looked at it, really.
I think I've seen snippets of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure in the anthology they covered it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's bits somewhere here and there, but yeah.
And yeah, so you've got Pete Shotton is there because he's you know, was once a quarryman, but it's like Lennon's friend who becomes the manager of the boutique.
Mm.
And later founds Fatty Arbuckle's restaurant chain.
Does he? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then sells it for an undisclosed amount of money, which I believe was a very, very big amount.
There's the
weird Beatles connection to Fatty Arbuckle's.
Yeah. And all the Fatty Arbuckle's I know of all turned into Frankie's and Benny's, so maybe that's who he sold them to.
Well, this was back in a long time ago. Anyway, but yeah, so there you go. It was the glorious hippie dream boutique that just collapsed into nothing because people were just nicking stuff left, right and centre, and also lots of people involved with it were coming in and going, oh, I'll have that then.
Yeah. You know.
So there you go.
Yeah, well, good stuff. And that was in December.
It was.
Lovely stuff. Well, then, let's get on with the first song of the week, which is Daytime, Nighttime, Suffering, Wings.
Where are the prizes for the game she entered, with little chance of much success?
Daytime, nighttime, suffering, Paul?
No, I'm fine, really. Generally, I'm okay.
In the daytime and the nighttime?
More or less, you know. Don't have a cup of tea too late, so you don't have to get up, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. You know?
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear
it. Right. Okay, this is a Wings song.
It is.
It's the flip side to Good Night Tonight.
Which we haven't done.
We haven't done that yet. Comes out on the 23rd of March 1979 on Parlophone. Gets to number 5 in the charts. Good Night Tonight does. Mm-hmm. It's in the charts for 10 weeks. Recorded during the Back to the Egg session. So I think this is the latest McCartney-based one we've done so far, because this is, like I say, it's 1979.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's recorded in early part of 1979 in what's called Replica Studio. And the reason it's called Replica Studio, this is a studio that Paul McCartney has built in the basement of the MPL offices, you know, his company, MPL.
Right.
In Soho Square in London. And it's a replica of Abbey Road Studio 2.
Okay.
Right. So he basically couldn't get booked into Studio 2 in Abbey, in, you know, so into Abbey Road. It. So he just got, I'll just build a version of it. So, Replica Studio.
Why not? It works. If it works for you, then, yeah, then why not build your own?
But yeah, this is Wings, but it's the later lineup of Wings that we've not come across yet in this series. So slightly different sound, although still Paul, Linda and Denny Lane at the core of it. But you also have Lawrence Juba on electric guitar, Steve Holly on drums with them.
Okay.
And yeah, it's an interesting bit of music, this.
It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I had quite high hopes from the opening harmony section, because it kind of opens up with a quite elaborate harmony a cappella. And I thought, ooh, what we're going to get here? And then the music joins in, and we have, shall we say, a bit of a, I don't know, quirky backing with a bit of a boppy poppy feel.
Yeah, it's those tiny it's little kind of bit of reggae feel in there, just a tiny little bit.
It's hard to say exactly what it is. But then it does go a bit darker when the chords modulate to a minor section in the river bit.
Yeah, the most interesting bit.
Yeah, which I don't think is the chorus. And maybe it is it's kind of like a second verse thing.
Yeah.
It's hard to say what it is, because then there's a middle eight twinkly bit, and then it goes back to the dark secondy verse thing. And then there's a bit later on, which is a bit frog chorusy.
Yep, I've got that written down too.
So it's like... So
he's pointing towards his ultimate piece of music, which is We All Stand Together. And everyone knows I love it, so it's not a cheap... That's not a cheap dig.
No. But
or a sheep dig.
Or a sheep dig.
Or a sheep dip.
Or a sheep dip. But no, it's... I mean, so I think that's part of the thing. It does have that kind of feel that of the McCartney three songs combined thing that he's quite fond of, but not in the usual ABC way that he often does. Because he keeps on going back and forth between the bits and having variations. And so so we're kind of slightly in the mess territory here a bit again, where it's a bit incoherent, but some of the individual bits I like. And I feel with this one more like if I spent more time with it, I'd like it more.
Because this is one that's a favourite of Paul McCartney's.
Yeah.
But that said, it's barely been available on anything, and he's never played it live and stuff. So, and it doesn't even get in the lyrics book, when actually, when we get to the lyrics, it could probably do with some explanation.
Yeah, it's not... we'll talk about that, but... I mean, because the river bits, as I call them, the bits where he's on banging on about a river, sound very soulful and kind of... Like, yeah, interesting sound to those bits.
Yeah, my favourite bits.
The rest of it, as I say, that's kind of like quite poppy reggae, and then it's interspersed with these kind of different breaky bits. Yeah, it's hard to comment on, really. It's such a strange bag of things. They're nice. I like the harmonies.
I do too, yeah.
But I do
some
think...
Good classic Wings harmonies.
Yeah, but you see what I mean? As an overall composition, it's hard to... I think the arrangement's a bit strange. He might have been better doing one of these kind of like Band on the Run type of songs where... He did the first bit, then he settled into the second bit, and then maybe he did some of his twinkly things as a break before finishing off on the first bit again, rather than going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards.
Well, I think there's an interesting story attached to this, in that so they're recording Good Night Tonight, knowing that they're going to get a single out.
Yeah.
And he's sort of thinking, well, that probably is the A side, I'm not sure, but we need something to go on the other side, whatever. And so he says to the band, he says, right, it's the weekend coming up. Whoever comes in with the best song after the weekend will get it on the other side of the single.
Right.
Now, the thing there is, like, imagine getting your song and your songwriting credit on a single that's going to sell as much as a Wings single will.
Yeah.
You know, the royalties would be brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
So everyone scurries off and starts writing. Apparently Linda tried writing one as well, you know. So everyone's scribbling away all weekend. Mm. And they come in and Paul's like, oh, I've written one. And we're going to do that.
So I was going to say, well, it's just the last person you want challenging you. Yeah. I've got an idea, lads. Let's all go off and write a song and see who's his best. I'm Paul McCartney. Go.
Yeah.
It's fair enough. Well, I'm going to give it 71 for music because I think it may grow over time, but I do think on first, second and third listening, it's kind of still a bit, now what's that happening with that? It's a bit, you know, a bit jarbled, which is...
Ah, jarbled, eh?
Jarbled, which is a great word to garble a jumble. Mm. So let's do production then. So I do like the sound of most of this. The backing bass is very heavy and high in the mix, which is always good when it's a Macca bass, you know.
Yeah.
This is kind of the music as well. You know, he is underpinning the groove brilliantly on his bass. It's a nice bit of bass on there, but it's also very, very present in the mix. And then we do have those kind of airy, twinkly sounds in one of the mid-eights and some phased backing vocals. So there's some nice little opportunities for production in this, isn't there, with those bits?
Yeah, but I think we are sort of suffering a bit talking about production in this series because it's not like doing the Beatles stuff when they're more or less always based in the same place and they're experimenting and pushing things forward and it's also been massively documented.
Yeah.
Here, what we've got for whether it's Macca or George or whoever, most of the time we've got them producing themselves but with a team of engineers and things helping them make really good recordings. And there's very rarely much weird to talk about, although I suspect we'll probably have to talk about some weird stuff in this episode. But like this is just good.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a good sounding record. Although it's like some of the decisions, like the organ sound on it's a bit weird. Yeah. Sounds quite like an electric organ, like an electronic organ. Sounds a bit cheap. Well, I quite like that.
Yeah. Is that the same thing as there's kind of a texture synth going on behind it as well? Is that the organ or is that something else?
No, I think that's something else.
Yeah. So there's kind of a synth that's there, but it's all adding texture and I quite like that as well. You only hear it once at the end. You only realise it's there kind of towards the end when everything comes out and it's still just, there's a sustained note going on. I guess even though it's, by this point, the general level of production is levelling out amongst most people, I guess. Mm. It's still the touches of things they put in there and decisions they make, isn't it? And I quite like the close miking of the bass vocal in the second midsection break frog chorus bit where we have a very close up dong, dong kind of thing. And that works well. It kind of feels a bit compressed and whatnot. And the harmonies are great, and I think capturing them like that's brilliant. Yeah, it is a good produced song, so I've given it 81.5 for production.
Ooh, a 0.5.
We've got a 0.5s.
Well.
It's taken to 10 episodes before I've started needed to introduce some 0.5s. Yeah, anything else then, production, or do we just move on?
No, I like the bit with the weird harpy sound panning across.
You know,
that stereo thing. I mean, this is one thing we can say, is the Beatles stuff, which I love in stereo, but they generally themselves weren't bothered about, and a lot of people love the mono mixes.
Mm.
You know, solo Beatles stuff is very much in the stereo world.
Yeah.
So you get these things where they'll have these big harp, this weird harpy sound going across there. And then the sound after that, about 2 minutes and a second into the thing, of a baby crying, which apparently is James McCartney. So.
Oh. Little baby James.
Yeah.
So,
James, son of James, son of James.
So, yeah, let's do lyrics then. So, like you said, I mean, it primes you to be kind of dark because it's got the word suffering in it for a start. A daytime, nighttime suffering, which is all the time, isn't it? So, it's not a good start. And then all I can really glean from the lyrics is this basically a load of rhetorical questions about what she got from all the love she gave you.
Yeah, it's some sort of commentary on sort of the role of women, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Which is, you know, it's an observation piece by Paul. I don't know that necessarily...
Is it, though? I mean, you're having to guess like me. I mean, is it... It sounds like, you know, if you're taking it on a very surface level, it sounds like you could be telling, like, you're telling someone off who's either actually abusive or at best, you know, what's the word, uninterested, kind of paying attention to someone and saying, what's she got for all the time she's giving you all this and you're giving her nothing, kind of thing, or you're making it worse or whatever. That's what it could sound like on the surface, but then it goes into the talk of rivers and streams and flowing.
Yeah, that's where it feels...
It's either disconnected
like,
or
totally
maybe...
disconnected, like, thematically, which is why I find it baffling that some of the things that he's included in the lyrics book...
yeah.
But not this. Whereas I'm sure he must have a lot to say about this. And I love the bit with the river stuff. It's almost sort of like it gets a bit spiritual type stuff. You are the river, I am the stream, flow mighty river through me. It's almost like a hymn of some sort.
Yeah, and it puts me in mind of some of his stuff that we won't be covering, which is his kind of Flowers in the Dirt era stuff, where he's talking about the world and the earth.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, you could, maybe he's talking about, that's maybe what he's talking about. Maybe his theme is more terrestrial, literally. You know, maybe he's talking about... I don't know, the planet.
And he gets on to let your love for your neighbours grow.
Yeah.
But he hasn't quite set it out in the terms.
No,
so
he hasn't.
It does just make it sound like, let it, you know, next door.
Yeah.
Neighbour. Not global, you know, world neighbours.
I would say it's a gumble or a jarble.
You can't even say that.
No, I can't get the thing I was going to get wrong purposefully right. I've lost my mind. One second. Never mind. They're not bad lyrics, but neither do they leave me with an impression of what this is about or even an abstract notion of what where it's coming at from, what it's getting at, even.
It's completely
broken me. So, let's just say, I'm going to say 65 for lyrics, yeah?
Oh, right, okay.
Which gives it 72.8 overall. Interesting one, interesting.
Definitely. I think it is a grower, but it's not going to suddenly grow more meaning.
No, as things don't. So then, next poll we have Meat City, John Lennon. Meet City, Paul.
Hello, City. I'm Paul.
Very good.
Had to. Sorry.
That's okay.
Terrible. Bad. Yeah. Right. Okay. This is the flip side of Mind Games, the single Mind Games from the album Mind Games.
Yes.
Okay. So it comes out on the 16th of November, 1973. Mind Games gets to number 26 in the charts. Hangs around in the charts for 9 weeks on Apple. Recorded at Record Plant Studios in July, August 73, I think. Written by John, produced by John. And it's a bloody noise, Lennon. It's just a bloody noise, this. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of this at all.
Yeah, okay.
I have my theory about what he's trying to do in it, but I'm not a big fan.
Right, interesting. You've let the veil slip. You've let out a bit of opinion there, Paul. But yeah. That's fine, you're allowed to. not the BBC.
Can't keep me down.
No. But, well, as John says, Paul, well. That's how he starts it, isn't it? Well.
Yeah, he does.
He screams in the song with a big well. And then a syncopated rock verse kind of... is the main meat of Meat City, isn't it? That kind of starts with a quite kind of rocky sound. Very heavy in a way, or it would be if they'd got the recording right, but we'll talk about that later. And then it goes into a very complicated, jazzy sounding timing bridge kind of fill to link it into a chorus, which is takes a nice key change, I think, and then has a mad, frantic... I'm expecting Klaus bass all over it.
You can expect it. You'd be wrong in this.
Oh, you're joking me. Yeah. That is ridiculous.
Given how many things he played on...
You've literally spent the last 15 songs saying, Klaus Voormann, Klaus, and then I've finally tried to guess it, and it isn't him.
No, it's a chap called Gordon Edwards. So you've got John on vocals and guitar, David Spinoza on guitar, Ken Asher on keyboards, Gordon Edwards, bass guitar, both Jim Keltner and Rick Marotta on drums, and Arthur Jenkins Jr. on percussion.
Okay. He's playing a very Klausy light. He's kind of like the whatever gets you through the night.
What John basically writes, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, what he asks
for. The way you put the bass alongside John's stuff.
Okay. So I find musically... So this is... this is a funny one for me because I find it hard to tell if it works or not. Is it? I'm not sure if it's genius or a bit of a muddy puddle. I think production-wise, it's the latter, and we'll talk about that.
Mm.
But let's imagine for a second the production was better and everything was clearer and better balanced. The tricky timing sections intersected with those strange noises and then the kind of awkward kinetic choruses aren't exactly catchy or that impactful other than that strange, disconcerting feeling you get listening to them due to them being so kind of jazzy and weird. But I don't know, but I like it. I like the madness of it. I think it's got some really interesting stuff in it musically. I just don't think they pulled it off.
My feeling is that this is John trying to write like Frank Zappa.
So
Zappa, he's worked with, they played together in 1971 and the material that ends up on sometime in New York City.
Mm.
And the difference is Zappa is by any measure a better composer, not necessarily a better songwriter, but he's definitely a better composer and musician. And so he can manipulate a band into ludicrous time changes. He can use a studio, tape edits, and do all that stuff very creatively in a very musical way because he's a composer, essentially. And I think John's heard some of his late 60s stuff, early 70s stuff, and gone, well, I'm going to try and do that where I have like a weird time signature change up here. Then it's going to have a cut with a tape edit and a strange noise.
Yeah.
The difference is that Zappa does it better.
Right, I mean, I don't have as much of that context as yourself because I know a bit of Zappa stuff, but not a huge amount. But I think you're right in the sense that I think it's going for the avant-garde in a sense, and I don't mean that. I probably got that wrong terminology. It's going to be something more jazzy, complex, different. But it's actually quite a conventional song under it all. But with those bits,
it starts out as a boogie song and it turns into this.
Those bits kind of faffed over the top, but I like the conventional song underneath it. And I quite like what it's trying to do with it. So I'm going to, because I know what's coming, I'm going to give it 80 for music. Because I quite like the song, but I know it's going to suffer elsewhere.
Your system is madness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Insert backwards speeded up message here.
So production then, Paul. This is where I'm balancing it out.
I've written one word for production.
Is it the word mess?
No, it's the word exhausting.
Yeah, I think, well, I've written mess, not just the one word. I've written more than that. I've said what a mess, what a shame, really, because that's what I think about it. I think it would be it's a great bit of music, I think, which is kind of let down. Its vocal is too quiet by far and kind of in the distance. The distorted guitar is way too swampy and just strangles everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The bass is too round for the style he's playing. It's way too flabby for going like all the time. The whole thing is kind of dull and should be bright, especially when it changes section. Something should change with it when it changes. So it just swamps from one bit to the next. Yeah. I like the cut-in sounds that happen a couple of times, but they lose their impact because it's cut in between messiness.
Yeah. So the first one is this backwards, high-pitched, speeded-up backwards message, which I believe is different on the album version than to the single.
Right.
The single version, I haven't checked this. I can do it at some point. The single version apparently says check the album. Right. And if you listen to the album version, it says F a pig, but not F. It says the full word.
Fluff
a pig. No, that's even worse. but yeah, so that's the first bit. Then you have that weird cut with a little bit of reverse tape noise. And then another bit where it's a cut when there's like a big striking chord thing there. And then at the end, you've got the almost like someone's left the mic on type thing. But I think he's done it deliberately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like that idea and the stuff. You know, I think it's interesting that he's been inspired by Zappa to try these things out, and it could have worked out well, but they not pulled it off. Those funny insertions and timing bits and complicated bits need clarity and space, but it's all very muddy. So I'd love to have heard a better recorded version of this, you know. I'd love to hear a well-recorded version of this, but I don't think it is. I'm going to give it 50 for production. I think it's one of the worst ones yet, unfortunately. As far as realising the what it was trying to do, and I think it's a real missed opportunity.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm not keen. I think it's very much Lennon going, I've got an idea, I've got the notion of rock and roll, and that's what I'm going to focus on, not actually the end product.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's do the lyrics then. So, we have that repeated rock and roll format here, but for me, a much more interesting style than perhaps the last Ringo one we looked at, where he was talking about looking in the fridge and all that stuff. I think I actually like these words.
Well, yeah, although I've been to the mountain to see for myself. To be honest, it's about the same as I went to the fridge and had a look. What did I see?
It is. But rather than just saying, I've been to the fridge, what did I see? I saw myself looking at me, now I'm down. This is been to Meat City to see myself. Just got to give me some rock and roll. People were dancing like there's no tomorrow. Finger licking, chicken picking, Meat City, shook down USA, pig Meat City. It's great. I like that. Snake doctors shaking like there's no tomorrow. Chicken sucking, mother trucking, freaks city, shook down USA. Those are great words. I really like them.
Nonsense, Lennon.
I like them. I think they're better than I'm down and out. I don't know what to say about them.
Goes into the bit about going to China, and it's apparently, you know, John had this notion that he could go to China and sort of knock on the door of communist headquarters and say, hello, I've got a rock and roll band here and we're going to free the country with it. You know, it just wasn't going to work then. It won't work now.
No.
So you have a lot of, I'm going to China. Woohoo.
Well, I like him. I like him a lot. Actually, I'm going to give him 83 for lyrics, but it's still 71 altogether because of the production dragging it down into the doldrums. Yeah. I think there's the makings of a really interesting song in here. I don't mind for the format of the lyrics being repetitive because it is rooted in rock and roll, but with that interesting Lennon-y twists, like the sounds of them. But it's just not the whole is as eluded him, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So let's move on to the next song, Paul, which is Deep Blue, George Harrison.
When the sun shines, it's not enough to make me feel bright. It's got me suffering in the darkness. It's so easy come by on the roadside from one long lifetime. It's got me deep blue. Oh, I'm deep blue.
Deep blue, Paul.
Right, well, I'm not going to make a joke about that name. This is the flip side of the single Bangladesh, which got to number 10 and was in the charts for 9 weeks on Apple. This is early solo George. It comes out on the 30th of July, 1971.
Ah.
Wasn't associated with an album, but is now. You'll find it as a bonus track on the CD issue of Living in the Material World.
Yeah.
Recorded in the Record Plant West in LA on the 4th and 5th of July 1971, with it being a George song. Obviously, he's a songwriter, and it's got a Harrison Spector production credit.
Has it?
Although I have a sneaking suspicion that old Phil probably didn't do anything on this one.
Yeah, you'd be able to hear it otherwise, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it hasn't got 800 tambourines on it. Very, very simple lineup. It's George playing several guitars and singing. Klaus on bass.
Oh, well, he's here now, isn't he?
He's turned up now.
I mean, Klaus.
And Jim Keltner, good old Jim Keltner on drums. Just those three together.
Yeah.
For what is a really extremely simple song, but very affecting.
It is very affecting, isn't it, Paul? It's a nice little song to sit back and listen to. It's very mellow, acoustic, with shuffly vibes.
Yeah, nice dobro guitar sound, you know, that sort of steel guitar sound.
Yes, yeah, so doing the leady bits.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think a bit of the Kinks. It's got a Kinksy feel to it. And, of course, George with his kind of For You Blue type of himself, you know, he's got obviously a George feel. It's nice because, you know, you get the feeling with George, as we're always talking about, his interesting construction of songs, and I mean that in the true sense of it, is that when they're less like that and more like this, you feel like he could probably rattle them off like this in his sleep if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But so much so that for him, this only makes a B-side, even though it's a great little tune, you know. I love the chord sequence, and even though it is one of George's more straightforward songs, it's still got that slight twist where it kind of does he return to the same chord in the minor or something rather than going between the first
and the
fifth. Yeah,
so the way he sort of thinks, so it's very much a finger-picked blues sequence, but he does that thing where he sort of shifts from it's like he's sort of capoed up on the seventh or something like that, and he's playing an E, but when he goes back to it, he sort of allows it to become like a bent sort of sound in it. So it's almost like a really bluesy minor push against the actual tonality of the piece in the verses. And then the other thing that he does in the chorus, he throws a C chord in there for a bit of anticipation.
Yeah.
Doesn't take you right back to where you expect to go, which is, as we've discussed, very often a George technique.
It's off-kilter mellowness and stuff, and he sings it really well.
Yeah,
and I love the fact that when we talk about George's stuff, he always gets you talking about those kind of things because that just shows what an interesting writer he was. And it's all played really nicely and all the lead bits are lovely. I'm going to give it 83 for music.
Oh, right, there you go. See?
See?
Yeah, there you go. See?
You're happy now, aren't you?
All you need is four chords.
Yeah. It just needs to be really... It's just good. I just think he plays it really nice. It's a nice song. Production as well, I think, sounds great.
Yeah, it's definitely less is more. He's very nicely matched guitar playing that he's doing, which is now sort of panned across the stereo. And then the decisions they've made in terms of what the bass and the drums particularly do and how much they sit back and out of the way.
Yeah, the bass is very low to the point where I was wondering, is that the bass was at the low end of the guitar? Now, I didn't mind that, though, because it's like it's there, but it's marking out like your finger picking, isn't it? You know, when you finger pick, your thumb's often plucking the bass note on the lower strings and you're picking the top strings. And he's just following that, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And that the way it's being mixed is they are like, it's like one nice big guitar with a big rounded bass low end rather than feeling like there's a bass doing its thing over here. They work together nicely. I think.
I agree.
It sounds like it's acoustic bass, but I don't know if that's just a...
It won't be. It'll be a bass guitar,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure. But
but I think it's very soft.
Yeah.
And his slide comes in sparingly with good effect. His voice sits nicely over it all. It makes me feel like I'm hearing a really well-mixed and mic'd live performance, which is what you want, isn't it, for a song like this?
Yeah.
You know, you just all you need is a when they finish for the polite clapping of the acoustic session crowd, and you would go, oh, yeah. But actually, you know, it's
George Harrison unplugged.
Yeah. It's better than that because it's nice. I mean, I can't see the Spectres anywhere near this. like you say.
Yeah.
So I've given it 81 for production.
Cool.
It's a good old song. Lyrics then. Well, we almost get a return to George form with the weather again. He starts off with the weather, at least for the first verse. He talks about the sunshine. Sunshine?
It's the sunshine.
It's sunshine, who we didn't know about. Yeah. No, the sunshine ain't enough to make him feel right. And therefore, he's deeping. Blimey, I don't know what's going on tonight.
Yeah, not doing well, are you, Gary?
Nim, nim, nim. He's feeling deep blue and whatnot.
Well, he has a very valid reason for feeling deep blue.
Okay, so why was he feeling deep blue this time?
Well, this does feature in I, Me, Mine in his book.
Okay.
There. He wrote it while he was like a year before this, and it was the year that his mother was suffering from and ultimately dying from cancer.
Oh.
So Louise Harrison, who of all the Beatle parents was one of the most sort of enthusiastic and supportive, you know, all the way through, right from George being a little boy up to his career in the band, you know, and really, really sort of being enthusiastic about it. You know, she's a big part of, but, you know, making George who he was.
Yeah.
And very sadly, yeah, she gets cancer and he spends a lot of time going to see her in hospital, obviously.
Mm.
And she dies on the 7th of July, 1970. She's only 59.
Hmm.
Bearing in mind, of course, George himself was only 58 when he died.
Mm.
It's, yeah, it's very, very sad. But yeah, obviously this is what he's written about it. I mean, he says in I, Me, Mine, it was written during the year my mother was very ill and dying. And after going in the hospitals over and over again, it's that smell and the whole atmosphere of doom that's in those hospitals. And that was that. When you stand and watch tired bodies full of sickness and pain, it shows you how helpless you really are when you get down to the truth. It hurts. One's inability to cure all ills.
Mm.
So, yeah. And that's when you sort of find that out and you think about actually the music itself.
Yeah.
Mellow though it is quite bouncy.
Dip, do, do,
do. And you wouldn't necessarily sort of think, well, that's how I'm going to discuss my, you know, the loss of my parent in this horrible way.
Mm.
But that's what it is.
Yeah. Sometimes that juxtaposition, I mean, it can be very effective, can't it? I mean, he's not trying to make... He's obviously not musically trying to make a sad song, but it is got undertones, if anything, of blues, and then it's called Deep Blue. And so the words, without that context, still work in the sense of anyone could take it and apply it to whatever. You know, he doesn't say anything about... I mean, he does say when you stand there watching tired bodies full of sickness and pain, so that's the specific bit, isn't it? Which is
and then
which ties it to this.
A verse about prayer and, you know, looking to his sort of spiritual side.
Yeah. It's but then he talked about repetition, which is the bit that kind of linked it for me to his, you know, I think Nirvana and breaking the kind of cycle is part of his his philosophy, wasn't it? So and I guess, you know, is kind of like is petitioning to that belief to get him through it. Obviously, you know, that links that together, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that context either, but also the repetition line, even though, I mean, it's the kind of song and pattern that you could, I mean, he's trying to not be sad. That's the point, isn't it? As well, that the last verse says, when I think of the life I'm living, pray God help me, give me your light so I can love you and understand. This repetition that keeps me here, which is what he's talking about, is the cycle of life and all those things. And he's feeling deep blue, but he is trying not to be. So if you had a song that was just overtly sad with these lyrics, there wouldn't be the lyric about help me to understand, would it? It'd be, I don't, you know, it would be wallowing, wouldn't it? So I think...
Well, possibly, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, actually. It's more interesting when the song doesn't sound like the content of the lyrics sometimes than when it does.
Yeah, and I mean... Ultimately, it comes down to it's based on a blues format anyway, and blues is hardly, you know, the most upbeat of origins in terms of what it was expressing and where it comes from. So,
but this song could easily, you could have lyrics over it, which was like, I was having a nice picnic and it would work for the music, wouldn't it? Because it's got
yeah.
You know. But anyway, I still think the lyrics are whatever are good. So I've given it 77 for lyrics, which gives it 80.3 overall.
Nice.
Right then, next we have Helen Wheels, Wings. Helen Wheels, Paul.
Well, yes, Paul McCartney and Wings in this instance is the correct credit.
Well, yes, okay.
This is one of the singles off Band on the Run. So this song isn't on the UK release of the album, but in America I believe it was bunged on the album as well.
Okay.
B-side of this is the thing called Country Dreamer. We haven't done that yet. 26th of October 1973 on Apple, gets to number 12 in the charts, stays in the charts for 12 weeks, which I always find interesting because you get retrospectives of like McCartney stuff or, you know, Beatles stuff and looking back and then looking at their solo careers, and you very rarely hear Helen Wheels.
I've never heard it.
You've never heard it?
Never heard it.
And it got to number 12. So it's one of the ones they record in EMI Studios in Nigeria in September of 1973. And then I think they do some overdubs in Air Studios in London the following month. Written by Paul, produced by Paul. And it's the trio version of Wings. Mm-hmm. Paul doing vocals, bass, drums and some guitars. Linda on her Moog synthesizer and backing vocals. And Denny Lane on guitar and backing vocals. And it is some glam rock boogie about a car.
Yes, yes it is. We'll get to that as well in lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
But we start off with a big opening riff. With promise, I thought, the beginning. I quite like that opening.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it kind of settles into that, like you say, glam rock, kind of fey Beach Boys.
It's very Beach Boysy.
And Chuck Berry-y.
Yeah.
Well, sounding.
The Beach Boys were Chuck Berry-y.
Yeah. So, yeah, all that lineage of music. Sounding rock and roll-y verses and chorus that doesn't really let up until we get like a little break. You know, the kind of verses meld into the chorus, and the kind of chorus is just the kind of stop where it goes, Hell and Wheels, and then it goes on. And then it repeats a few times. And that's it.
Yeah, it's a journey song.
Yeah, some of the breaks have drums in them, which I also like. But I can't help but notice that's the bit when the music stops. The bit I like is when they've got the kind of like percussion going. There's also bits where the music seems to be getting away from them a bit, or they don't all come in or stop on cue.
Well, it's start of the third verse. So, like, in the little link before the third verse, like, Paul's playing some twiddly bits up on the neck of his bass guitar.
Mm.
And then the verse starts again, and he forgets to go back down to his root note.
Yeah.
So and the walking bass line. It's about 2 minutes and 8 seconds that happens. And it's like, where's the... Hang on. And then it comes back in, and it's like, oh, we missed that one.
Yeah. And you think, come on, Paul. It's what year now?
1973.
1973, you can't just leave him in like you used to back in the old days, McCartney.
Well.
I'm not massively into this. I find I just not... This is the dark side of glam.
The dark side of glam?
Well, it's not the dark side of glam. It's the kind of boring grey side of glam. It's just that kind of like... It's not, you know... Because of the way it sounds and the way it's been... It's got that kind of... fakeness to it, which is bizarre for a performer and writer who was there playing rock and roll back, you know, introducing it to a lot of people as well, and it's to be kind of like doing these what this sound like pastiche of rock and roll. I don't like them. I'm going to give it 59 for music. I'm not a fan.
He's not.
Not a fan of this. I'm finding with the wing stuff. You know, for want of a better word. I am finding it a bit Marmite with some of my scoring. I either tend to really find them really interesting or just think, ooh, no. You know, only on a couple of occasions. But I think there's going to be some... Paul's are going to be quite high and simultaneously some quite low at the same... You know, I think it's...
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think they occupy the middle ground that much.
Well, there's more to come.
Yeah, there's more. But, you know, production. I don't find the harmonies are as good as usual in this one. Not singing-wise, but I'm guessing Linda doing a high harmony and bits.
Yeah, yeah.
It really doesn't sit very well, I don't think. I don't think it sounds as good as normal.
I don't think the production's very good, and it's not been very well sort of treated historically.
No.
I wonder if it's going to be in the box set with a new mix, you know, the new singles box set.
Okay.
With a new remastering. Because I'm not a big fan of the way it's mixed at all, especially not the drums.
Well, they've affected the vocals as well, haven't they, to make it sound like they're doing it through a... I don't know. Have they done it to try and make it sound retro?
Possibly that was the reasoning.
But it doesn't sound retro, it just sounds squeezed.
Yes, I think that's a good word for it.
Thin and tinny.
Yeah, the drums to me sound like they've stuck one microphone in front of the whole kit.
Yeah.
You know, rather than spot mic all the different bits and pieces of it. So I'm not mad keen. Do you know what? In my mind, I've heard this song plenty of times.
All right.
But in my mind, it sounded better.
Yeah.
Because I've remembered it different to how it actually sounds.
Yeah, it's got little glimpses.
The production is what does for me. I quite like it otherwise, but yeah.
Well, I've given it 60 for production. I've mentioned that the synth that occasionally comes in is okay, but 60 for production I've given it. Then I've got to lyrics.
Right, now this is in the lyrics book.
Is it?
It is.
I mean, did it need to be? I mean, it's just a driving down from Glasgow down to London, isn't it? And then he's hit upon the word Hell on Wheels, sounds like Hell on Wheels. But is there more to it?
Let me find it in the book. There he is. Photo of him sat in his Land Rover. Hell on Wheels is the name of my Land Rover. I'd like it to just say that, but it doesn't. But yeah, he's basically talking about it. You know, he's writing a road trip song about the fact that, you know, in America you can do Route 66 and it takes days.
Yeah.
And in the UK it's very hard to drive for days because...
Yeah, you get to the other end of it.
Yeah, but basically he's saying about the longest journey you can do is from London to where he lives in Scotland.
Yeah.
And so that's what this is, which is, you know, he talks about to Carlisle and Glasgow and Liverpool and Birmingham and stuff like that. Basically, it's going down the M6 for most of it.
Yeah.
And, so...
It just sounds so dull for Paul McCartney to be talking about driving down the M6. You think, why are you driving down the M6? Surely someone should be driving you down the M6, or you should have
Well, here's the shock discovery I've made today.
Yeah.
I hope everyone's prepared for this. Hold on to your trousers. Because in the lyrics book, which, as we know, hasn't been out long, he says... In any case, the idea of doing an English road song was challenging but rewarding. I like the idea that a song like this still has legs, and I actually still have Hell on Wheels. She's still running. They're built to last, these things. Well, I checked the tax website for cars. It has had a statutory off-road notice issued. Hell on Wheels is no longer drivable.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's maybe, off-road at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, he could be running it around his farm.
Yeah, it's true.
I think you'd probably be okay on your own land.
But yeah, it's not he's not taking it down the M6 anymore. And if he is, he's breaking the law.
Brilliant.
That but, you know, for a car that was first registered in April 1970, it's...
yeah.
He's definitely has lasted, you know, if... but yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I think.
See, but, I do my research. I spy on the McCartney's car.
It's gone a little bit creepy, but...
Well, no, that was only because I noticed in one of the photos in the book, one of the 70s photos, you could see the number plate, and I thought,
yes,
oh,
of course, yeah, you can just check up on any car, can't you? That's interesting.
But he does throw in that little line, Sailor Sam came from Birmingham, but you'll never be found, so it does tie into the band on the run
thing, yeah. I mean, what is it with former Beatles and driving songs, Paul? I mean, this is two of them now. And we know that John's got one at least mentioning wheels.
I mean, not quite the same word.
Yeah. But, and, you know, is Ringo going to be popping up next on his, I don't know, a dose of rock?
Mini Metro.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I get that he's going for the Beach Boys, Chuck Berry songs about driving around bit, but he's doing it in the UK. I do like the references to Liverpool, Birmingham.
Yeah, the idea
London.
Of the West Coast sound is a good sort of pastiche of that thing.
Then we missed out Stoke, but I guess he must have gone south on the M6 through Birmingham and then cut across on the M40 to Oxford, rather than cutting east through Stoke onto the A50 and down onto the M1, which probably didn't exist at the time he was writing this song.
He didn't come off at Junction 16 and go down.
No, he mustn't have done. But I don't think that A50 link across to the eastbound was there. So that's about as interesting as I find the lyrics, though, to be honest. So I'm going to give it 49 flicks because I just don't find it. It's just a driving song. It's not. I'm not bothered about it. I mean, the Hell on Wheels pun is, that's it, isn't it, really? That's as much as you need.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
So I've given it 49 flicks, which gives it 56 overall.
Oh, dear.
Not done so well, but, you know, he can't have everything, can he?
No.
So finally, Paul, we're back with George for Pure Smokey. Smoky Paul.
No, can't think of a pun for that one at all. This is the B-side to the single True Love, which is associated with the album 33 and a Third. Comes out on the 19th of November 1976 on Dark Horse. It did not chart, as several of George's singles didn't. Recorded at FP Shot, produced by George and Tom Scott, as we've seen on a couple of the others, written by George, obviously. It's a little band of George doing vocals and guitars, Tom Scott doing like saxophones and arranging the horns and stuff, Richard T on electric piano, Willie Weeks on bass, Alvin Taylor on drums, and it is a song ostensibly dedicated to saying how much he likes Smokey Robinson, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
Because he did.
Yeah.
But he has chosen to do it in a manner that I find almost impossible to concentrate on.
Why is that? Because
I've said this before, I think, probably again about a George song, I can't remember what it was, but sometimes it's such a wash of sounds and the particular frequencies and sort of combinations of things, particularly in this case the electric piano is what annoys me, that I find this really hard to listen to.
I mean, the Pure Smoke is laid on heavy in this song. It's pure smoke, it's filling up the room, I can't breathe. No, it's going for that silky,
it's very smooth 70s sort of
soul. In buckets though, isn't it? It's like, this is smooth. How much smooth can you get? Some more smooth down your face, you know.
But it's not as nice as like a 1970s Smokey album, you know. There's an album by Smokey Robinson called Pure Smokey.
Right.
From 1974, which sounds much nicer than this. So you should have tried to copy it.
This is the most... I mean, I don't know. I can't... I know the names, Smokey Robinson, and I'll know some of the music, but I'm not great with linking them. What song would be the kind of linchpin that I would be able to grab onto?
Gary, the one that you really, really like is You Really Got a Hold on Me.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but
that's earlier, obviously.
That's not like this.
No.
did he do more stuff like this then, eventually? Did he do more stuff the smooth kind of...
Yeah, definitely moved more towards this sort of stuff. But
yeah, okay.
I don't think George gets it right.
No, I mean, it's got all this kind of bends and jazz and, you know, I thought it was going to be an instrumental. So he did make that kind of cardinal single mistake that he's made before of not singing till about a minute
and
past.
And it fades in.
Yeah. Which I wasn't kind of imagining. I thought, we've got another instrumental here. So it was strange for George to suddenly do a weird kind of smooth kind of type of weird jazzy thing, instrumental. But then when he started singing, I was thinking, really? Is he going to sing on this? Because it's hard to think of George. I mean, George was a very good-looking man, but it's hard to think of him as as sexy. You know, this has got the kind of, ooh, yeah, vibes to it. And it's, but, and I know it's weird because it's not about that. He's not saying those words, but you can't hear music like this without expecting the voice to come in to start. Maybe it's because we're the generation of what's his
face. You can't hear him wearing a medallion, can you?
No, it's this song is Silk Sheets, isn't it? This is Come Inside. Who's that guy? What's his name? Who's
you thinking of Barry White?
Barry White. It's got kind of sound.
That just makes you think of Vic and Bob.
Yeah. It's yeah. So
show
it's just
your liver.
And yeah, it's. I'm just not entirely sure. I want to hear George's voice singing this kind of thing. And it, even though he's not saying anything, that's not. We'll get on that with the lyrics. It does feel strange. The music's fine. I quite like a bit of smoothness, and there's still a bit of George's chords modulations to keep it not just background smooth music. The verses come and go in a strange fashion. The chorus is kind of built into them, really. I don't think there's a. It is just a. It's a mood, isn't it? Rather than a.
Puts me in a mood.
Yeah. Nah. I quite like how the last note on the electric piano goes wrong and they just left it in. They play the wrong note, don't they? They finishes on a note which is.
I don't know because I can't concentrate on it enough to remember.
Yeah, I've only given it 69 for music. It's I don't think it's bad music. I just don't think it's George. It just feels a bit strange hearing him do this.
Yeah.
It's the strangest one of. We've not had anything like this so far, have we? This is just a bit out of left field. Production then. So the song has a clear remit. Pure smoky. It got to be smooth and non-abrasive. And I think it does that, I think. It does feel a little smothered in places.
I think it's absolutely drenched in places. The electric piano is really, really hazy sounding and it's on everything. There's too much horns, too many, too much. And as I've said before, it doesn't seem to have the confidence in his voice to put it at the right level in the mix. And so you lose it inside the wash of sound.
Wow. Yes, I've got whether George's voice sits well in the mix is debatable in places.
Yeah,
all the way through.
The places between the start and the end.
Yeah. But overall, for me, I think for what it's doing, I don't think it does a bad job of it myself. Whatever this is, I don't think it's something I'm massively keen on, but...
I'd like to hear a better produced version of this where they controlled it better, controlled the instruments better, gave George's voice the chance to actually deliver what he's saying.
Oh, well, I've given it 80 for production, but it's too late to change that now. I thought he did a good job of creating whatever the feel of this song is meant to be because it's got quite a clear remit and they've done that. But hey, you know, that's just me.
Right.
Lyrics then. So I had to look it up because I didn't instantly know that Pure Smokey had anything to do with Smokey Robinson. So I spent a little while trying to think what the heck it meant. And then I had to look it up and then, oh, of course, right. It's about Smokey Robinson then. It's a very specific theme for a song, but, you know, that's good.
But he does try and extend it back to extend it out to the notion of giving thanks for things before it's too late to.
Yeah.
You know, to say, you know, I like you, you do good stuff, thank you. Which you should do. You should tell. I know it's just very strange because we live in a world of social media and creators seem very remote.
Yeah.
But you can say thank you to Paul McCartney. He might never see it, but he might, you know.
Oh, yeah.
More importantly, say thank you to people who do the smaller things because the encouragement is always appreciated. Tell people that they're good, you know. And George obviously felt the need to sort of say, you know, I've really, really liked Smokey Robinson's voice and his music, you know, and that's what this is. He's chosen him as the example to lead us by.
Yeah.
To lead us by, to be led by to us, if yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'll just leave you to pass that. And I've given them 66 for lyrics. All right.
He does say in I, Me, Mine, he says, I'm trying to make the point. If I like someone, I want to say I like you. I don't want to die and then to think, oh, I forgot to tell them that I like them.
Yeah, but you can't write a song about everybody. No. Yeah, I suppose they didn't have social media then.
He's just telling you to say thank you.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's good. It's just as a
That's
theme.
That's why when I got to see the scaffold thing, and I, you know, Roger McGough was there, and he was very important to me growing up in terms of like my discovering poetry and liking the sort of stuff he did. And I'm very, very, very shy, but I wanted to say thank you. Mm. You know, and I'm sure he gets lots of people saying thank you, as I should imagine so, but I needed to do it. And yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, good. We can write a song about it.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's good. It's fine. I like
it. Pure 66. Rog.
66 for lyrics, because even though that's a nice sentiment for writing a song, it still doesn't... I mean, there's only a handful of songs in the world of artists talking about other artists that of note, aren't they? But it's fine. It's fine. It's good. It's strange as an A-side to a single. Was it an A-side?
No, B-side.
B-side. Oh, no, it's fine as a B-side just to a single, so why not? So get 71.7 overall, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to the end of episode 10. 10 episodes in already.
Wowzers.
I don't think we're halfway, but we're not far off, because I think it's about 25 episodes, did we work out in the end?
Something like that.
So I think we're just under halfway, but we have reached that 10-episode point. So I thought this time we would do a top 20.
You know, Gary, fill your boots.
Yeah, but let's start off with the four that didn't make it in from this episode. So, from this episode, at number 43...
Out of 50.
Helen Wheels. At number 29, Meat City. At number 28, Pure Smokey. And at number 25, Daytime Nighttime Suffering.
This list is bonkers.
It is a bonk. It is harder this series for me, because I'm coming into these songs cold, a lot of them, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas the Beatles ones, it was a lot easier to have kind of milestones and reference points to think about when a song came up.
It's you're gonna harder. Get to the end of this process and you're gonna look at this list and you're gonna go, this is rubbish.
What does this mean?
Who did this?
No, I think the top, like with the Beatles, I think that was kind of the case with series one in some sense, you know.
Yeah.
But I think the top end is quite reflective of what I really think.
Yeah,
I kind of don't mind if things fall in the middle somewhere, because I don't have enough of a gradient to know the real difference between a bunch of singles I hadn't heard. But I'm enjoying very much listening to them and trying to figure that out if that's possible. But I do think the top end is turning into be a nice list of things a lot of which I didn't know existed. So
cool.
That's good. So this is the top 20 so far. At number 20, John Lennon, What You Got. At number 19, Your Love Is Forever, George Harrison. At number 18, What Is Life, George Harrison. At number 17, John Lennon, Remember Love. At number 16, Backwards Traveller, Cufflink, Paul McCartney. At number 15, Yoko Ono, Yes, I'm Your Angel. At number 14, Deep Blue, George Harrison, New In. At number 13, John Lennon, at number 9, Dream. At number 12, My Love, Paul McCartney. At number 11, My Love, George Harrison. At number 10, John Lennon, Power to the People. At number 9, Jet, Paul McCartney. At number 8, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, John Lennon. At number 7, Cold Turkey, John Lennon. At number 6, Yoko Ono, Kiss Kiss Kiss. At number 5, Give Peace a Chance, John Lennon. At number 4, John Lennon, Stand By Me. At number 3, Paul McCartney, Loving Song. At number 2, Band on the Run, Paul McCartney. And at number 1, Paul McCartney, Another Day.
Righto.
I think I should have said, it's Remember Love's Yoko, isn't
Yoko,
it?
Yoko, yeah.
Yeah, I meant Yoko, but...
I know, everyone knew.
Everyone knows that. So now we've done 10 episodes, Paul. Our usual kind of format back in Series 1, when we were doing, you know, such a large collection, is to have a bit of a bonusy break at this point.
Yeah, a Beatles bonus break.
Beatles bonus break, so we should hopefully be doing that. We've got something hopefully in the wings for next
wings.
Week. Ah-ha-ha. It's not wings, though. It's not wings.
The unexpected Wings reunion that suddenly occurred.
Paul McCartney wants to talk to us, but only about Helen Wheels.
Yeah. I want you to do a 10-part podcast series on Helen Wheels.
Oh, imagine.
To commemorate the statutory off-road notice that's been applied.
I mean, it's just such a... unlikely thing to happen, but imagine how bad I'd feel if suddenly I did find that Paul or Ringo listened to this in any capacity whatsoever.
They'd have had you killed by now.
I'd hope they'd understand that it all comes from a place of love. You know, the ones that I don't like. But, you know, it's always... Anyway, so we won't tell you anything about what the bonus might be until it's happened, and if it doesn't happen, we'll think of something. But after the bonus episode, we'll be back before Christmas still with the next episode, which is going to be our Christmas special, isn't it, Paul? Would you like
to... Yes, we have extricated from the mix all the Christmas and New Year songs that come out as solo singles during the 70s and thereabouts.
Yes.
And so that means we can, we can do an actual episode that belongs in the list.
Yes.
So we'll finally work out the best Beatles Christmas song, festive holiday sounds.
So that should be fun because it's, and also canon with the whole list. It's just going to, we've taken them out of the random factor so that we can do them all in one go. So that should be very festive and should be coming to you in a couple of weeks. And then we shall have a break over Christmas and we will back in the new year. But you don't have to worry about that just yet because we've got a bonus and another episode before Christmas, all being well. So thanks again and we will see you for that. And see you soon. Bye.
Beatles.